Watch that. It was like the Three Stooges plus one. And one of the effects of it, one of the effects of watching that is actually you come out of it with sort of, you know, a renewed respect for the level of discourse in Canadian politics. No kidding. Okay. So it seems to me what you have is a society with a desperate need for alternate versions of its own reality, first because they're getting simply, what they're getting simply ignores what they're actually living through. So it makes for bad viewing and reading, and a lot of them just stop buying papers and watching TV, the news on TV, and they go to the internet or to Seinfeld or something. And two, because what they're getting is destroying the possibilities for a decent life for themselves and those they care about. But you have a media establishment, a mainstream establishment, uniquely unqualified to provide those alternate visions, both because of their own limitations and because of the impositions of the new structures of ownership, this kind of concentration. And I'm really referring to, as far as the changes in ownership, to Ben Bagdikian's thesis. I presume a lot of you know it, about the media monopoly and so forth. If you don't, it's all laid out there. That's why I say those of you in journalism but outside the mainstream are in a unique position. There's a desperate need for alternatives, and it's not going to come from inside, I don't think. So it seems to me it's a great opportunity for you, but a hard one to seize. First, maybe because the alternate press doesn't quite seem so alternate anymore. It seems to me that it seems that the alternate press, there used to be these walls between the alternate and the mainstream. It seems to me with the end of the Cold War and that sense of a dichotomized world, the alternate press became less alternate because there aren't those separations in the same way. The alternates aren't sealed off by the absolute moral and political distinctions of the Cold War. To some extent, the alternate press has become as kind of, rather than an oppositional world, they've become kind of farm teams for the mainstream press. And there's much more movement than there used to be. And when, you know, who the hell wouldn't want to write or work for, a big news organization? And if there's the opportunity, you think in terms of it. People move over more freely. They don't demonize us as readily. And we don't demonize them quite as readily. That's personally been my own experience. When I started, I felt that I had, in my own sort of case, I did everything possible to make sure that I would never have anything like a weekly column in the Globe and Mail. It's not that I would have turned it down if it had come up. You write for readers, not for the institution that you're writing for. But it never occurred to me that it would be a possibility, and I had accepted that. I was, I just wanted to get my voice out, and the consequences seemed likely. Well, that hasn't, that's things have changed to some extent in that respect. I could write freelance stuff, but the actual thought of actually having columns in those mainstream media, they just told me. Occasionally I would ask them, I'd ask Peter Newman or something. He'd say, "Oh, I love that piece you wrote about Barbara Emile. Don't tell anybody I said it, but I love it." And I'd say, "Well, in that case, how about a column?" And he'd say, "No." And it was more or less that clear. And there were a lot of incidents like that, and that's no longer the case. And I don't think I'm exceptional in that way. And it seems to me that they have loosened up. At the same time, it seems to me that the road in for people from the alternative media, see, it's not, I think you find it happening at, in the level, I think Naomi Klein is going to be here tomorrow. So she writes weekly for The Star now. So I think you find a real spread of people of different ages and backgrounds finding more access in the media. I don't understand it completely. I find it interesting. But I would say the road in from the alternates is largely in the realm of culture and cultural criticism. I know they like to sort of point at me and say, "Well, we're not so bad, we're not so right wing," but I am on in the arts and entertainment section. I'm in the pansy patch, as they call it at the Globe. not in the not op-ed or And it has to be under the rubric of culture and cultural criticism. I don't feel all that clear about what these things mean, actually, and I'm glad to discuss them with you if you want. We'll have, you know, I won't take much longer, and I hope we can have some discussion. But it seems to me the only place that the alternatives will really emerge without being ghettoized into cultural and cultural criticism kinds of journalism is going to be outside of the mainstream. When the Cold War ended 6 or 7 years ago and the West emerged as the only side left, I'm sorry. Let me just find my spot here. It's a bit messy. You know what? I think I'm missing a page. No, I'm not. It's okay. Sorry, no. So, I'm sorry. What I was trying to say was, that long digression was part of saying you've got a great opportunity, but you've got some problems in taking advantage of it because it's harder to be alternate than it used to be. And also, it's always been hard to be alternate. We all live in this society, and we're all affected by it. You don't get to be different just by declaring you're going to be different. It's a great thing to try. But I'll give you a couple of examples. At this magazine, in the mid-80s, in one of those periods when we were sure we were going to die, which is the nature of most of a lot of all of it, and somebody always has to come along and throw in new energy and revive it. Nick Fillmore came along, and he'd run the Fifth Estate or the Fourth Estate in the Maritimes, and had done one of those alternates in the Maritimes. And then he'd come down, and he called us up and said he wanted to work with us. And the way he was going to revive this magazine was, he said, he was working in the mainstream at the time of the CBC, and he said, all over the country, there are journalists at the mainstream media with great stories that are being suppressed by those fucking reactionaries who are running things. if Nick could come in with us and work with us, and we would raise some money to help pay for some of this, we'd get this flood of stories. So we ended up with two. It just wasn't that there was this great flood of stories. There are some stories being suppressed, maybe, but there's not that many. And when you look at actually what we produced or still produce, it's hard to say how it's different in style, in content, because we're all products. It's just actually very hard. Alternates are difficult. I mean, I can remember when I worked in theater a lot, and people in the directors I worked with, when we were all sort of younger and there was that kind of alternate movement in Canadian theater, and then some of the guys, the directors that I'd worked with, started taking over the mainstream theaters, the big stages. And, I'd say to them, okay, what are you going to do? And they'd describe a season that was exactly, it was one musical, one classic, one Shakespeare, one Canadian play, whatever it is that they do. It's not that easy to come up with something that's genuinely different. We all live within the frame of this society, and it's not that easy to step outside. I mean, to me, I wrote something in the Globe this morning, if you don't mind, for those of you who read it, just repeating it, that OPSU has an ad on TV currently. I don't know if you've seen it, of the workers, different workers saying, we know things have to be cut. We know things are too expensive. There's got to be cutting. It's just we want to be part of it. Which is amazing to me. But they have basically bought the framework that the government and the mainstream media are running on. And as I say, there is this alternate way of looking at the problem of the debt. They can say, we know there's a debt problem, but it's not because of us. You could have ads that said that. But it's very hard to step outside of the framework, and it's easier to kind of make gestures, but to actually find ways of concretizing and living a different life, it's very limited how much you can do. If you actually asked what would a truly alternative press look like, I still don't think I could answer it. And I worked in alternative journal for over 20 years. You're looking for things. Another example of why it's hard to come up with alternatives, this is just a guess on my part, is that for some of you, you grew up in the age of Reagan and Thatcher and Mulroney. And I think it's kind of hard to picture things being really different. I mean, what people say to me, including, you know, people who consider themselves oppositional and alternate media, but if you say to them, well, I mean, what's your actual, I mean, do you believe in, I don't know, do you consider yourself a socialist or something, or even a leftist, they say, well, they don't like using that language, and then they say, because it's not going to happen. I mean, I had the advantage of growing up at a time, it was not to my credit at all, I just had the luck of being your age in a time when the majority of people believed that major change was possible. So you didn't feel embarrassed if you talked about a different future. You didn't feel it's not going to happen, so why make a jerk of myself? I think actually embarrassment is the most powerful human motivation. I also think your unique post-Cold War situation, though, can work for you in this role of posing alternatives. For me, you know, I think I still think in terms of some of those older, you know, dichotomous notions of alternatives. For a while, I abandoned the notion of socialism, you know, shortly after the end of the Cold War. I just didn't know what it meant. It seemed like a useless phrase. I find myself coming back to it, you know, mostly because when you see what capitalism in all its glory and unopposed by anything does, you think, well, hell, there ought to be an alternative. It doesn't have to be that Marxist variety. And it makes sense to me, but it's pretty vague and formative. But I think it also reflects the fact that I grew up in that situation. If you're basically living outside of those Cold War models, you have a unique opportunity, it seems to me, to formulate alternatives and criticisms without the burden of that history and that tradition, and above all, that language that we grew up with. You were one side or the other, and if you couldn't stand the way things were, you were against it, and you were almost forced into a certain tradition. It had to do with Marxism and a certain terminology. Personally, I always found it actually oppressive. It was okay being part of a great left-wing tradition. It was an honor and all that, but it was also as if there was nothing fundamental for you to discover. You were going to make a revolution, okay, but mainly to implement what others had already figured out. Your creativity would come in making it happen, in the execution, but not in the imagining of it. Actually, I find it much more exhilarating to live in a time when there's a terrible and undeniable need for alternatives, but no grid or formula to lay them out on. That was what the last, I spent the last 2 years, up till about a year ago, writing a novel about the future, the near future in Canada. And it started off, it was going to be on the model of a British series called A Very British Coup, set in the near future. And the main character was going to be a scientist like Suzuki, who gets involved in politics and becomes prime minister, and then he runs into all kinds of problems and so forth. And as I was working on it, and the way you do those things, basically, I mean, these things have been done since the Cold War, since the end of the Second World War. You basically have a grid. It was the Cold War. It was East versus West, capitalism and socialism, and so forth. And you pick a few characters and you kind of toss them on the grid, and have some sort of plot incident, and then you see what happens. Well, as I was doing this thing, this exercise, the grid vanished. There was no Cold War, there was no East-West, there was no, and in terms of Canada, the grid vanished too. The parties disappeared. And I found I couldn't do the, what it became was, instead of what happens to a Canadian in this situation that's been going on for so long, it's what happens to anybody when the situation itself becomes amorphous. So I actually changed the character from the Suzuki, the sort of scientist guy who gets involved in politics, to an actor who's got a background in improvisational theater. Called it the Age of Improv, and he gets into power and he has to improvise his way through it because all the scripts have gone to hell, they're all down the toilet. And the only thing left to do is instead of relying on the scripts, be creative. And I think that's the situation that I envy you for being in. So those are some of my thoughts on this subject, and I'd be glad to have any discussion you want. What should we do?
I suppose we can open it up for discussion for a little bit and then move on from there. So if you have any questions for Rick, please feel free to drop your hands and ask away.
You sort of speak of this as perhaps this might be not comfortable, but I mean, I think any of us in this room would be lucky to get a job there. You know, that's still just sort of way beyond there. It seems for the most part. I'm just wondering what sort of I don't know if it's advice or, but I mean, where should we be looking? Sort of, you know, creating something.
How can you get into Esquire? No, it always comes down to that. I mean, that's a completely real question in anybody's life. The reason I sort of talked about the student press was because, you know, at least that press is funded. And, you know, so it's possible to do something. There, you know, what is the question? I mean, do you mean it really personally?
Well, okay, what would you do? You know, you're basically, you're going to be finishing university and some of this, you know, pretty soon. I've got, you know, pretty big goddamn list of debt to pay off. And yeah, I've got a degree, it would be shit. It's not going to get me a job anywhere, you know, since an RSA, you know, maybe if it was a math degree or something. I really enjoy writing, you know. I enjoy doing what I've been doing.
Well, I don't have an answer to that. What I'm saying is this is not career counseling. I'm the worst person to ask. I've never had a job in my life. No, literally. I mean, I've never had a punch in. I've never had a boss. I've never had to be anywhere on time. But I did have the immense advantage of being in a time when you always knew. I mean, the great thing of being able to freelance, start in, say, 25 years ago, was you knew if it didn't work out, you could get a job. So I'm not, but I just don't have, what I was saying, and it's much more abstract, and it's not going to help you with your question of what to do with your life, is there is a desperate need in this society for alternate media. And the mainstream media are getting less, and it's a genuine need. It's a need that individuals have because they're not satisfied with what they're getting. And they're turning away from the media, and it's a need that the society has because it's a society that's strangulating, and but I don't, you know, that's an abstract point. That's not got to do. If somehow somebody could figure out how to fill that need, I'm convinced that's there. I'm sorry, I feel terrible that I don't have anything more. No, honestly, no, it's a completely real question. I can't think of anything to say. I mean. I'm sorry to go on with it, just because I feel so guilty for not answering. I do feel, it's true there's a huge amount of competition with people out there, you know, who want to be journalists and all that. It's amazing how few of them can actually turn in something on time and, you know, reasonably clean and all. I mean, it's not hopeless, but it's, yeah, somebody else.
You said that you publish in the Globe because you want to talk to, you want people to read your stuff. What would you feel if at the Globe you found yourself with a platform that you could, where you would have a lot of readers and you would be able to present alternative points of view, but they said to you, you should be happy just with a platform, we're not going to pay you. And then they started laying off the paid journalists at the Globe. Would you feel like you were being a scab? Or would you be happy with
the
platform?
It's like science fiction.
Where?
If
the local
Globe
would have a black newspaper.
Oh, God, thank you. Before I did a real double take. I mean, I have thought about, I don't know, just theoretically, if what you're saying, I would not have a particular problem writing for nothing. I mean, I've always assumed, but again, you know, I come from another generation. I don't want to sort of, you know, make you feel, I mean, it's just because I had the luck to be in that situation, but what I've always done is figured out what I wanted to write and how I could, you know, bring in the amount of money I needed to keep going year by year, and then just did it, and I didn't particularly care what paid for what. So in a way, I mean, you know, it wouldn't happen at the Globe, and I wouldn't let it happen. But I wouldn't have a problem with writing for nothing. But boy, if it was a way of getting other people out of work, no, I wouldn't do it. Absolutely not. You wouldn't even have the excuse of, you know, you're supporting your family or something. No, that would be much more meaningful to me. That would be to me a clear moral situation. You just don't do it if they're using it. It's just straight scabbing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, I have a bit of a situation here where I have the perspective of having grown up mostly in the 70s, being 30 years old. So I have seen the alternatives of, say, Trudeau and people along that stripe, and seeing the spectrum move to the left from that situation. Now, you
to the right.
During your talk,
yeah,
to the right.
Yeah.
Well, the wrong direction. It's late.
Yeah.
But yeah, having the spectrum move to the right. Now, you were saying it's more difficult these days, if anything, to be alternative. But if anything, with the perspective that I have of having seen the 70s, I would say that it's easier to be alternative because ideas that used to be mainstream have been pushed, like it used to be mainstream or moderate, have been pushed into the alternate, making a lot of people basically alternate in one fell swoop.
Yeah, not just alternate, but surplus to a large extent.
True. Yeah. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, no, I think, well, that's what I was trying to say. I mean, these things are not one thing or another. You know, there's opportunities and there's problems. I actually, overall, I think it's a great time. I don't know if, you know, if any of you, you know, are afflicted with the kind of 60s syndrome. Believe me, it was nothing so, you know, it was a kind of a trip, but it was full of rhetoric and bullshit. And this, you know, and I think that people who are kind of in journalism or critical today seem to me really much more, I just am much more interested in what they have to say. It just seems to me much more clear-headed. You don't get that incredible Maoist, which I was participated in, that sort of reversion to rhetoric and terminology. I think it's actually a much more clear-headed and exhilarating time for people who are trying to understand what's going on. Let's take some. Here.
You were talking about the inroads to the mainstream, you were talking about it being through cultural criticism. I guess it's probably because it's kind of a safe area to be cordoned off as the Hanley division. But I was
I'm
wondering
not sure.
where you would think that the other people, you know, the people that do come into the press, where would they be coming from? Is it through politics or that they're coming into press?
Which other people?
Well, not everyone in mainstream media has come from
sort of
alternative media.
No.
Well,
a lot of them come from the J schools, isn't that clear?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's now, I never did the J school route, but I taught it. I had a chair at Ryerson for a couple of years in the journalism school. So, I mean, most of the students were there not because they thought they were going to learn anything. The main function of journalism school, as far as I could see, was to, you know, beat out of you any idealism that you had and go. And it was very discouraging, and the main task of the students was to keep, you know, try and keep some sort of sense of what they wanted to do it for. But they felt it was a ticket, and they needed to get in. And it was a terribly difficult problem because, in general, what I could tell in the class, the students who would do best at getting jobs in the mainstream media were what I considered the dullest students. And I could just smell it, and I've seen it's happened since. I don't know. It's just it's. I mean, being. I don't know exactly. It's just they come from the normal places. I guess I'm thinking of people who identify themselves as alternate and so forth. Yes, somebody here. Yeah.
Could you comment on the role of fiction in presenting alternatives, both fiction within the press, such as Saturday Night, and fiction such as novels or stage
plays? Do you want to say more of what you're thinking of to make it a bit? You know, let's.
Well, you're talking about presenting alternatives to social alternatives, so I'm thinking what do you see the role of fiction in presenting alternatives?
See, I don't think of fiction as having a role. I mean, it may, but I don't think if you do it, you don't do it. You mean, do I write fiction because it's an alternate way of doing social criticism or changing society? Is that sort of the intent? Because I tried that for years, mostly when I was doing theater. I always had a bad conscience about it, because it doesn't produce the best stuff. I mean, basically, what's just wonderful about fiction is you're drawing on a completely different part of your mind. You don't have a clue when it's working best. You don't have a clue what you're doing. I mean, you can sort of try and add some things when you do your later drafts, but it's if that's what you meant, you know, to what extent does it? I don't mean to dodge it completely, because for a long time I considered myself a person with social and political concerns who used writing to get those across. It was that same sort of embarrassment as I had when I went to Montreal and said, I'm not really a journalist, you know. I'm just. And more what I found was the writing impulse had taken over. And it just goes its own way to some extent. I know this isn't responsive to what you're saying, but I haven't much more to say to that. But this morning I did a piece about this OPSU ad in the Globe, and I felt kind of terrible about doing it, because everything in my political background says you don't criticize people when they're out on strike. You don't say anything that would make them doubt their leadership. It's a real lack of solidarity. Everything in the political, I still am not sure why I did it or if it was right, but I thought what I had to say makes sense, and something in me thought, I write, and this is what I see, so I should write it. And I think you do get that conflict between, you know, your conscious analysis and your goals and your impulse to speak out when you write.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the fate of Linda McQuaig at the Golden Mail. When I ask you, do you ever find yourself editing or censoring yourself when you write, knowing that you're writing for the Golden Mail, the extreme right newspaper?
I think about it. You know, I think it's hard. You know, it would be very dishonest to say I don't think about it. Usually I go ahead, and to my surprise, I'm still there. I'm always surprised when I open the paper and find it. And someday I won't. As far as the Globe itself, you know, the sort of stance I've taken with my as a way of sort of getting myself through it is, I write each column as if it's the last, and one day it will be. It's gone on longer than I thought. To be honest, I think where the actual censorship might come in is more. I don't say things, when I write about the Globe, I may not be as nasty as I'm inclined to be if I write about somebody at Toronto Life or Saturday Night or something, because I'm in the Globe. And I think that's actually simply a matter of kind of courtesy. It would look really graceless to be in their house, as it were, and to just, you know, behave with, you know, utter contempt. You can at least indicate that you know that they've invited you in. There's something like that that goes on. I think that's the closest I can come to it. Somebody up here?
Yeah. I was just wondering, in terms of a writer's voice and being heard, I'll use the example of Allan Eagleson's story. He's a Canadian, came out in the Boston Herald Tribune. How does that happen? Like, how is it that the Canadian figure of such magnitude, nobody here raised the issue in Canada?
It's embarrassing. I think the Americans are actually much better at that sort of thing. They have that free speech tradition, the First Amendment stuff. There are levels on which it is a more open and democratic society. I think it's stupider, but it's they have the muckraking tradition. I do think the answer is cultural along those lines. And there is a kind of, you know, I think it also has to do with is, it's the viciousness of the capitalist marketplace. I mean, you found it in theater too. You know, if you worked with, you know, Canadian actors, I don't know, you know, you'd work with them, they were very talented and all that, but boy, they were lazy, a lot of them. Not all, but, you know, compared to working with American actors, every time they got out there, they thought, this time I'm going to score. This is my Emmy performance. This is going to take me to Hollywood, something like that. There is something of that in the difference between the two cultures, too. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, even McLean's, I think it was James Dean,